In the next half hour, you'll hear a special May Day feature about the Pilbara strike, the longest strike documented in Australian history, lasting 3 years, starting on the 1st of May 1946 and ending in 1949, where around 800 Aboriginal pastoral workers in northwestern Western Australia went on strike. You'll hear from guest host Mick Clune, an AWU delegate, organiser with Unionists for Palestine, and member of the Victorian Socialists, whose family comes from Victoria Plains, Western Australia, on Ute Country, the site of both New Norcia and the Moore River Native Settlement. Declan Ferber-Gillick, Central Arunda man from Mbantwa, Central Australia, an Aboriginal communist, trade unionist, and member for Unionists for Palestine. And Oscar Martin, a proud Bundjalung and Killamaroi man and currently the Indigenous representative on Students Council at the University of Melbourne Student Union. Mick, Declan and Oscar discuss wartime and pastoral workers' conditions, the lead up to an outbreak of the strike, solidarity movements throughout Perth, the role of strike camps and the lessons learned. The conversation starts with a discussion on the significance of the Pilbara strike.
The importance of it being initiated on May Day was about actually just seeing the connections between both Aboriginal people and the larger working class force in Australia. So what it would be worth going into is just, yeah, putting into a bit of a context about what's actually going on during this time. So it's like early to mid 1940s, we're coming out of World War II like conditions where basically Indigenous people remain heavily, heavily oppressed and heavily exploitable part of the workforce, whether that's in the pastoral industry, large sections in the shearers industry as well. We can date this back also to the 1890s, where there's a large entrenchment of Indigenous people in the shearers industry as well. So we're getting into the early mid-1940s, where there is, Indigenous people are still largely quite oppressed. And there is concerted attempts by the Australian state to actually persecute Indigenous people on their land and so forth. So huge, huge segregation, huge taking away of Indigenous children, be part of this process, to initiate them in this process of assimilation. So taking away them from their communities, telling them, they're not black, get rid of their culture kind of thing. Mm. And say that, you have to integrate into white society. And this was, in WA, this was happening right across the state. Mm. And so I think that laid the kind of basis of where this strike was coming about. In the Pilbara region, Indigenous people were heavily, heavily oppressed and were very exploited as being part of the workforce in these areas. And I think that was part of the reason why, our idea of a strike was trying to be brought about, as to say we need to combat these kind of parts of oppression. So,
and yeah, we can actually see in Layla Clendon's writing that Aboriginal labour was the backbone of Western Australian pastoral industry at the time. Mick, do you want to talk more about the pastoral industry and the place of Aboriginal labour in it?
The pastoral industry in Western Australia was a key industry, if not the key industry. So today you think mining, for sure. You've got Gina Rinehart's and the forests. The forests were around back then, and a lot of what they had was pastoral land. The key thing that kept the economy going. So when we talk about restrictions, when we talk about slave-like labour, when we talk about the repression and all that, that is profitability for the pastoralists who are at the head of the economy, and they've got roles in parliaments. They own the press and the like. So in terms of what we're talking about a situation where you've got the most oppressed section of society coming up against, the most powerful section of society, and the pastoralists directly profit off of the conditions that are imposed upon the Aboriginal pastoral workers and the working class more generally. And when we're, faced with the context of genocide in Gaza in Palestine today, it's important for us to reflect upon the very radical traditions that exist in this country and that are often masqueraded and hidden, because that's something else about the history of colonization in Australia, is that a lot of the stories of resistance are not ever told, and if they are told, they're emasculated, to use a crude term, and not given the credence that they're due.
So Aboriginal people in the region, both in the workforce but just as a subjugated and colonized people, were living under pretty harsh conditions, laboring under very harsh conditions. If they were paid at all, they were paid very little. Women were working as domestic workers and basically not paid at all. Men were paid a fraction of what the white workforce were paid. People were paid in rations. tea, tobacco, flour, that kind of ration system. And we've heard that towards the end of the war, that ration system really tightened up even more. So people were living under very strict conditions, and also were living a seasonal relationship in the sense that people lived where they worked, but they were subject to very harsh treatment by the bosses. Even it wasn't like a kind of freedom of movement when we think about seasonal work, like laborers being able to travel and seek work. People were actually restricted in that.
I mean, the thing about it was, is that so in the dry season, you'd often live in a camp near the workstation, but in the wet season, often the camps were near riverbeds and the like, and so it rains and they, you know, you need to move. And so what they did is that they put Aboriginal pastoral workers in the sheep stations, and you had to live in the sheep station and get up and then go work, and you were not allowed to move.
These conditions all came to a bit of a head in the first months of about 1946. And there was this general sense by blackfellas across the Pilbara region that something had to be done, something had to change. And there were meetings called. And in fact, there was a mass meeting of about 600 people, including senior law holders from across the region, including actually from as far off as sort of central towards Central Australia. People came from Alice Springs, and you know, people might know that both through work and through traditional cultural songlines, there was travel, and there was, you know, people did traverse that region and that country from what's now called Northern Territory over into WA. So there were family relationships and kinship relationships, as well as people moving along those stock routes.
The meeting was very significant, I think, on multiple levels. In terms of just initially talking about the idea of a strike, so what would that actually look like for the Indigenous community and workers? How would they actually go on strike? And so discussing that was really crucial. One of the important things about this period as well was active involvement of parts of the white workforce as well. And importantly, I think members of the Communist Party of Australia actually making a bit of an intervention into this scene. So one of the big figures of this was Don McLeod, who made an actual intervention to say, hey, I think you guys should actually go on strike. And actually discussed this not only at Skull Springs, but right across Western Australia and other key centres of industrial workforces and so forth, to say, hey, we're thinking that in the Pilbara region, these Indigenous people would want to go on strike. We should drum up support, whether that is funding for the strike or, you know, political social support, in the way of establishing solidarity. And I think this was really important in terms of actually linking up the broader working class within Australia with the Indigenous population itself as a key backbone to say, hey, we're in this together. We're going to fight against Western Australian capitalism. We're going to fight against the broader Australian state. And I think this is really important. And it gave a bit of a push for certain Indigenous people. There's a really great quote by Clancy McKenna, who was one of the big strike leaders of the Pilbara strike, where initially the idea of a strike was being circulated around by Don McLeod and others. He said, which I think really is indicative of the kind of like real authority Indigenous people took upon this kind of idea. He said, McLeod gave us a hint about the strike and we took it up. So really asserting Indigenous people to be like, we're going to lead this. And that's so, so empowering in the sense that we're going to fight against this and we're going to resist. This is part of who we are, this is what we're going to do so that we can, you know, get better wages, working conditions, rights, and et cetera. So I think this is a really important time in linking up those connections, but then giving, you know, there's this incredible power for Indigenous people to say, we're going to do something about this, which I think is so important.
And there was really important leading voices and leading forces amongst the Aboriginal labouring population. Dooley Binbin was one of the strike leaders. Clancy McKenna was another. And they were both arrested and actually arrested and kind of regularly over the long strike. I think it is really important to recognise this Don McLeod, who was a communist and was a member of the working class and an active member of the Communist Party, and was a white man and had quite favourable social relationships with blackfellas in the region, just due to treating them basically as human beings in the way that bosses didn't, which was, you know, something quite significant at the time, unfortunately. You know, I read that he had developed relationships just simply by taking blackfellas to hospital when they were injured on the job, things that bosses didn't do. And so he was sort of trusted amongst the Aboriginal workers and was invited to that mass meeting, the Skull Springs meeting. And he was the person who came with this idea as a communist to say, here's a tool. A strike is a tool. I urge you to take up this tool. there was democratic deliberation against within that mass meeting, which was conducted in quite a culturally authoritative way amongst elders, and they really thought through this idea of the strike and then took it upon themselves to implement and carry out that strike.
They had this program called the Communist Party's Fight for Aborigines Draft Program of Struggle Against Slavery. This was actually drafted in 1931. This is an important point Michael brings up, because this is drafted in 1931, 15 years before the Pilbara strike actually started. And what this draft program actually outlined was a concerted political intervention to say working class people and Indigenous people can fight together to end the oppression of Indigenous people. So we can actually grant land rights, wages, conditions, you know, improvement for Indigenous children and their health and education, in pretty quite hostile context of, you know, the Australian Labor Party, you know, not really actually fighting for Indigenous rights, certain sections of union leaderships like the Australian Workers Union being quite anti-Indigenous as well. This was very, very important. And I think one of the key aspects of the Communist Party Australia's history that was really crucial is that at the rank and file level, loads of members of the Communist Party of Australia really wanted to push to really fight for Indigenous rights. And this is really indicative of that, I think, as well.
And McLeod himself said that the mongoo, so mongoo was a word that, it's a word for people, but it became a word for the local people. That's my understanding. So the mongoo bonds of kinship and culture and the resilient social organisation could provide a strong foundation for the strike movement. You know, McLeod, as having an egalitarian politic, identifies within that community that, you know, this is Aboriginal cultural governance and Aboriginal pre-colonial economic life was an egalitarian society. It was a classless society where resources were shared and communities were developed along lines of kinship and governance, and responsibilities were for country were divvied up in a way that wasn't a system of exploitation. For a working class Aboriginal communist politic in general, it is really important to recognise and make that connection, that what's shared between pre-colonial Aboriginal society and what is valued and what is shared and valued in a working class or a socialist or communist politic is that sense of egalitarianism, but specifically economic egalitarianism. You know, economic egalitarianism is what we as socialists see as a just future that's worth fighting for. It is extraordinary that without anything like the kind of communication that we've got today, this was a word of mouth thing. You know, this was communities, probably largely kinship and extended kinship networks, working across a whole range of stations that are over thousands of kilometres, people travelling on the back of a truck, but also sometimes by foot or on bicycle to spread the word of this strike, you know, like 6 weeks out. And something, a really beautiful and I think incredible story of commitment and resilience and ingenuity was that one of these Aboriginal strike leaders, Dooley Binbin, he was an older fella, and he would travel around from one station to the other on a bike or on foot, delivering jam tins. And what was written on the jam tins actually was a little calendar with people to mark down the days to the 1st of May, May Day, which is when everyone agreed that the strike was going to take place. And because he was an older fella and travelling on his own, there was a kind of story told about him by all the workers on the stations that provided cover from the bosses who, you know, obviously they didn't want the bosses to get wind of the strike. And they would say, oh, don't worry, he's just this old, you know, poor old relative. He's, you know, he's probably on the way out anyway. Poor thing wandering around visiting family before he passes away. But little did they know he was actually organising across, you know, thousands of kilometres towards this big day and bringing this unified consciousness to all these communities and to his kin.
On May 1st, 1946, you get this outpouring of, you know, hundreds of Aboriginal pastoral workers and domestic servants, who are women who are mostly unpaid, almost always unpaid, going out on strike. And then immediately you've got the state cracking down, and a Labor government, by the way, cracking down in quite a harsh way. So they lock up Clancy McKenna and they lock up Dooley Binbin. And not only do they lock them up, they've got chains around their necks. Like it's classic sort of humiliation, brutalization, and repression in a way that would actually set a standard that couldn't be acceptable to the labour movement. It couldn't be acceptable that someone could go out on strike and then the response could be that you put them in chains, literally, around their necks and lock them up. And that's the precedent that the state was setting. And they were trying to set that because the workers that they were locking up were Aboriginal.
There was actually a protest of 200-odd people in Perth who were outraged by this jailing and the cruel treatment of the strike leaders by the Labor state government. And that led to a kind of solidarity movement in Perth and the development of a committee. People did pay attention and were outraged at this archaic treatment of Aboriginal workers at the time and the development of that solidarity movement in Perth. I know there were some meetings there and a committee developed.
It's the usual suspects. You know, you've got Communist Party members and the like. You've got trade unionists. I think there were some students there as well from UWA too.
I think there were women's groups as well and local Noongar elders and activists.
Yeah, and they went down to a protest on the 28th of May to oppose the sort of the repression that had been meted out against Clancy McKenna and Dooley Binbin. What we have there is they used to have trams in Perth at the time. They ripped them up in the 50s for the motor industry, as I did across a lot of Australia, but the trams were down. It was a stormy night, and so you had 300. 300 might seem like a small number today, but back then in WA, for 300, majority white, a few Noongar elders there as well, to show solidarity for an Aboriginal strike up north is a pretty incredible effort. And there were leaflets written by, you know, Communist Party agitators to promote the protest. There was probably people out doing stores to promote it. You know, it was in the papers and the like. And yeah, you have this outpouring of solidarity with Pilbara, and also to assert that down south as well, Aboriginal people do deserve the same rights. So it sort of, it universalised the question for Aboriginal rights as well.
And yeah, when they got together for that 300 strong meeting at the Perth Town Hall, they launched the CDNR, which was the Committee for the Defence of Native Rights. There was a Noongar elder and activist present at the meeting who got up and defiantly announced, "Today we are demanding at least similar privileges to the white man and our freedom. These concessions have been too long delayed." The legislation that governed Aboriginal people's lives was draconian, and it was something that effectively controlled every aspect of their lives, from their freedom of movement, their rights to unionise and to have representation within the labour movement. It becomes really clear that this strike was about Aboriginal people's development and resistance to settler domination of their lives in general in the area.
The ruling class tried to relate to this movement in its early days and how they tried to denigrate the Noongar elders and the Aboriginal elders who stood with the communists who had organised this solidarity campaign. Because what we have is we've got Tommy Brofo, who's a Noongar elder, who says, you know, "Today we are demanding at least similar privileges to the white man and our freedom. These concessions have been too long delayed." I mean, quite a moderate statement, but, you know, an important one at that point. The Commissioner for Native Affairs, Francis Bray, at that time, says dismisses Tommy Brofo and says, "They've achieved very little except that the communists enlisted some dupes for the purpose of communist propaganda." And so in response to this upswell, quite unprecedented strike on May Day, the way to denigrate this and put this down is to say all these blackfellas, they're the dupes of the communists, which you also then had the press working against the strike by imposing a media blackout. They just did not want to cover the Pilbara strike at all. The only press that was out there covering the Pilbara strike and taking this to the population more broadly was the workers' press. So it was the party press of the Communist Party, particularly their paper, The Workers' Star, that would send messages of solidarity and feedback reports across the broader union movement. And so I think what you have there is an indication that it is important to have press that's independent of the capitalists, essentially. It's independent of those with a vested interest in ensuring the reproduction of exploitation and oppression. That's where you have the necessity for the party press that flows from that. Because, yeah, the media blackout was total.
Understanding the role of the media in this era, in middle of last century and today, as being a function of ruling class propaganda is really clear to see.
The press, because it was a party press, could be used as a organising tool as well. It could be used to organise solidarity meetings. It could be used to organise workers in the wharfies. It could be used up north as well as a tool to cohere people and execute a line, because it wasn't only revealing information. There started to be action that came from the information in the press that then affected the world in a really active way and subjectively actually changed the conditions that they were operating in and changed the outcome of the strike.
Because it is quite amazing that it goes for 3 years. And I think it, alongside the repression, like even there wasn't, I think there wasn't a strike fund organized as well. So like we're talking about a strike that goes for 3 years, large repression, not that much money to actually help out the strike. Yeah, the question is, how does it survive? And this is where the cooperative mining camps and camps across the Pilbara region get organized to actually run the whole entire strike, but also provide the support and the backbone to the strike itself. So it's a bit of a supplement to the strike effort to fight for better wages, conditions, and better rights. So what do these camps actually look like? Well, community, like elders and community people within the region get together and run through what needs to be organized. So things such as like childcare and cooking. These things were actually organized on a democratic collective basis where everyone was involved organizing, running these events so that, you know, people could be fed, people, you know, children could be cared for and educated whilst people on strike and so forth. And these camps were so instrumental that the Indigenous workers were able to continue to actually go on strike while the community was being able to run things in a democratic way and done it collectively. And one of the amazing things, which are, you know, not totally unique within the workers' movement and in revolutions more broadly, is these sort of camps and how the way things were run democratically, especially on the front of like childcare and so forth, was that it brought other sections in the population forward in a political sense. So Indigenous women actually were brought forward in a real serious political manner. They took up lots of leadership roles because these camps were able to be run in a collective sense. It wasn't just like, you know, the classic thing in capitalist society, women do all the work, they take up the childbearing, they're the ones who lead the nuclear family. That was just like, whatever, you know, kick that idea out of the window kind of thing. And the camps were able to say, actually, women can take a leading political role in the strike and how it's organized. And that was even done in the training up of teenage women as well. So you could see this is like laying the basis for future generations to say, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a woman or like how you're usually oppressed, you can actually take a leading political role, which I think was quite significant in the way the camps were organized, not only to sustain the strike, to give the confidence for Indigenous people, both women and men, to politically lead and say, hey, we're going to fight for what we want.
Yeah, I think it just speaks to, you know, what we should understand as the limitations of particular forms of action at any given point in history and at any given point in a set of material circumstances. So the strike camps went a certain way in being able to challenge and disrupt and actually, you know, deal a blow to a particular sector of industry. But ultimately, when those strike camps developed into cooperatives and when those cooperatives developed into their own form of industry, industries of that kind, cooperatives and smaller scale kind of independent movements come up against the reality that like this continent and the world is subject to the capitalist mode of production, and they can't actually transform people's lives en masse. You know, movements do become accommodated to the capitalist system. They do become accommodated to that mode. And so there's only so far that an independent kind of radical movement can go. And we need to link up these struggles over time. And that's, you know, that's the job of kind of day-to-day organizing and education, is understanding that you're struggling within the conditions that you're struggling in, and coalescing broader movements over time is necessary and only strengthens out the broader fight.
One of the things that you mentioned, Michael, about the class stratification within Indigenous society is so, so crucial to understand, because I think that continues right today. It's even a bigger thing today as well with the development of the large integration of Indigenous people within the working class, whether, you know, if it's in urban land areas or rural areas in the Pilbara or so forth. It gives that dynamic of not only, you know, you're being exploited by the bosses in whichever industry you're in, but you actually have a power to wield over society where you withdraw your labor and you can actually demand things, whether it is better wages or conditions or social and political demands like land rights and so forth. So I think that kind of class stratification stuff is really important to understand because it continues to develop in today's time, which I think is an important lesson to understand coming out of the Pilbara strike, where we do want to locate where people actually have power and actually wield that power to say, hey, we want to actually fight for the improvement of our communities, the improvement of our people in today's time, because, you know, Indigenous oppression hasn't gone away. In most circumstances, it's actually gone worse in multiple areas. And I think having this focus to being like, well, we want actually the work, you know, power of working class people to really fight against this whole entire barbaric system is so central in how we actually can win for a better world.
You know, you had the church, you had the state, you had the partialists. They were all working together to ensure that the colonial project was a success. And often, and too often, oppressed groups in the working class are seen as two counterposed and distinct categories. But what the Pilbara strike really demonstrates to me is that there's an integration and a politic of solidarity that can cut through all that. And with that politics and with that power of the working class, you can make significant gains on the question of Indigenous oppression, but also lay down an example that we can continue to use inspiration from to today. This story is talked about and it's taught and it's understood. And it's a part of culture. It's a part of, you know, the history of community and how to revive that and how to sort of take that forward. And that shows to me that the Pilbara strike demonstrated was that it's a living, breathing culture that can link up with the forces today to actually transform the world in a positive manner and link up with the class and the world in a way that we'll never able to. Like, we're talking about black strikes on May Day. Like, there's one 40 years later in South Africa of 4 million people. These things are now a part of the same history because of that sort of universal process.
I think that sometimes what can happen in you know, popular discourse and in the kind of popular activist imaginary is that there's a kind of pre-colonial Aboriginal society and then there's a colonized Aboriginal society, and that those two things are you know, a kind of binary, and that we're living in the latter half of that. But I think that what you can see as Aboriginal people have become part of the working class over the decades and part of struggle and have engaged in struggle that has led to, you know, big gains both in the labor force but also as agents of labor, those kinds of struggles gave rise to a political confidence that led to other really big gains and struggles in the consolidation of community wins, like what we saw in Radical Redfern and in that Black Power Redfern era. What you see is not a kind of like binary pre-colonial and post-colonial Aboriginal politic, but an emergent proletarian Aboriginal culture that is politically on the front foot, that is really theoretically sharp, that knows the gains that Aboriginal people stand to win, to know that power is found in linking up with allies with historically informed ways of dealing with their conditions. Here's how we have a chance to correctly analyse our conditions, set demands and fight for those demands. And I think that's where we can see the greatest gains have been won.
In terms of today's time, like, the issue of Indigenous oppression and Indigenous politics is becoming more and more of a class question. The Aboriginal population is ballooning, and most of this Aboriginal population are actually working class blackfellas who, you know, actually can now actually hold so much power in terms of going on strike and actually fighting against the capitalist system. Our job as socialists is to always retain these memories of struggle and resistance and always learn and apply the lessons of such struggles in today's time, because often you see either these strikes or acts of resistance washed away completely from history or completely bastardized. And what we should be saying is that actually what's the basis of all this kinds of stories and struggles is that we need to fight, and that's the way we win. As seen in the Pilbara, it was done by the fact that Aboriginal people and working class people side by side fought and won.
The Pilbara strike of 1946 to 1949 was a watershed moment for Indigenous and workers' rights. It's a little known story, yet it is one of Australia's most radical. A 3-year strike starting on the day of international socialism that involved white communists and workers uniting with Aboriginal pastoral workers and their strike camps to resist and defeat the power of the pastoralists, parliament and the press. It's exactly the sort of tradition we need to revive today in the fight to free Palestine from the river to the sea. Big thanks to guest hosts Mick Clune, Declan Ferber-Gillick and Oscar Martin for their commentary on this history and for their time in the recording and production process. For more on the Pilbara strike, head to deadlystory.com and search for Pilbara Strike. The track used is Clancy and Dooley and Don McLeod, performed by Shane Howard. The unabridged version of this conversation can be heard later this week via podcast at 3cr.org.au/May Day 2024. Thanks for listening to 3CR's May Day special broadcasts.